Well, good morning. Good morning. I actually had marked a place in here that I then lost. If I can find it quickly, I have a. The song that we sang a few moments ago, From You I Receive, I was looking at the sort of nomenclature, and in the lower right after the music it says, Rabbi Irregular. I think I figured out what that meant, but it took me a second. It took me a second to figure it out. It's always sort of dangerous to come up with a topic for your talk before you actually wrote it. The sort of subject that I identified as the topic stands, but the dramatic title, What's the Big Deal, may seem a little less relevant as I go through my talk this morning. It's been a while since I've been with you on a Sunday morning. People were worried, the people who came early were worried that there wouldn't be much of a group, but you look pretty good to me. I'm glad to see you all. We don't get strong winter weather out this way too much. I have congregants who live on top of some mountain or other, and they weren't off of it until Friday, I think. So, you know, glad to see you all here. As I write this, I'm sitting at a Starbucks in Lexington, Kentucky, on my way to Chicago in a 12-foot Penske truck. I'm bringing my daughter, Talia, who's gotten herself a job at a very fine restaurant and an insanely expensive restaurant near Lincoln Park called Alinea. The weather's delayed us, and we're sitting a little uncertain what the rest of the day will be like. We were supposed to make a relatively early start and get to Chicago by 2 p.m. to unpack and return the truck. But as it says somewhere, man proposes and God disposes. In the scheme of God disposing, this is not high on the scale, but it is a reminder that things don't always go as planned. And according to the events of this particular move, nothing goes as planned, although it all ended well. The airline ticket I'd purchased to get me back to Asheville by Thursday afternoon is going to have to be changed, along with the concomitant frightening additional costs, which will be high and unreasonable since I'm not flying Southwest Airlines, what I think is the only reasonable airline in the country. However, on the other hand, I get to spend another day with my daughter, who has lived with me since August, who's been a good roommate, whom I'm going to miss more, I hope, than she's going to miss me as she moves into this new chapter of her life. And by the way, the man who taught me that phrase about man proposing and God disposing was a professor at my undergraduate school at Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, a fellow named Ned Rosenbaum. He retired early and purchased a farm somewhere in Kentucky, taught some college as an adjunct, and prepared for whatever retired professors of Bible do. Except one day last year, he got caught in a flash flood and drowned. I'd like to dedicate the few words I speak this morning to him, to Professor Ned Rosenbaum, one of the professors from college whom I stayed in touch with for many, many years. So I thought to speak to a group of Unitarian Universalists on the matter of covenant, knowing, I think, the general attitudes of my audience towards such things as revelation, God's immanence and will, and so forth. What I mean is that I'm well aware that Unitarian Universalism represents one of the highest moments of liberal religion, fiercely dedicated to ethics and the life of the mind and the spirit, but less than overwhelmed with the claims of traditional religion, be it Christianity, Judaism, or Islam. Spirituality, yes. God, maybe. Literal revelation and all that that entails, probably not. The point that I'll be driving toward is not intended to be conversionary, either to Christianity or to Judaism. It's my intent to take the next few moments to explain a few things in the hope that I can apply my specific points universally to suggest a way of using the term covenant in a modern sense. I'd like us to see an ancient idea applied to our modern condition. So let me start with modernity, one of my favorite topics, as modernity, as I understand it, threw everything traditional under the bus, at least as far as I see things. This is not the moment to enter into a complex analysis of how the 19th century, say, differed from the early 18th, and in fact how technology of the late 20th changed things as well. A nuanced analysis of all levels of change is certainly not possible in one sermon, likely is not possible in one book. For our purposes, for my purposes, modernity refers to the scientific and political revolutions that began actually in the 18th century, moving into the 19th and beyond. The first issue I have in mind is the rise of democracy and the death, in many places at least, of autocratic rule by a king, a queen, a prince, or the church. The democratic impulse insists that those in authority must think of everybody as people in general, all having an equal share in the common weal, instead of a ruler who governs populations how he or she wishes, often capriciously. I understand this most with the Jewish experience, who, as democracy emerged in Europe, became a conundrum for the British, the French, the Germans, among others, who all began wondering how to bring Jews who'd been seen as a separate society into society as men and women in general. The single most famous example of this that I know of lies in a statement by an 18th century French deputy named Clermont-Tonnerre, forgive me, my French is terrible, who put it, quote, "We must refuse everything to the Jews as a nation and accord everything to the Jew as an individual." The democratic impulse insists that we reduce, even eliminate, much of our ethnic particularity for the sake of the whole in order to become a citizen of the democratic nation. The democratic revolution, by its nature, is an imperfect revolution, of course. We will always have to struggle to understand and implement its underlying impulses. We will always have to compare the status quo with the impulse of democracy. But that the impulse is inevitably there is the point. The other aspect of the revolutions of which I speak is the scientific revolution. What I have in mind covers a great deal of ground, so much so that I'm allowing myself to speak in vast generalities, something one can do in a sermon, but never in an actual academic paper. These scientific revolutions have compelled us to see the universe in largely rational terms, in terms of laws that operate in a consistent manner, laws that remove God from the causality of things, laws that allow us to understand how things work in a very deep way. This rationalism, this scientific rationalism, uncovers so much about the universe, feeds into skepticism about the claims of traditional religion. Methods of textual analysis and historical research produce a world of, for example, biblical scholarship that's miles and miles from the notion that from the Jewish perspective, God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai, or to the general inerrancy of the Bible, that claim one hears a great deal about in connection with many Christian groups, whose notion of inerrancy usually applies to the King James translation of the Old and New Testament. How translations from the Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek are seen as errorless is another inquiry altogether, but is worth mentioning, if only in passing. So we moderns are confronted with a strong scientific knowledge coupled with skepticism of many of the claims of traditional religion. So what remains? Did God give the Torah on Mount Sinai? Was Jesus a supernatural man, half God? And if the Torah is not divine revelation, and if Jesus was but a man, what then are we left with? Have the entailments of modernity destroyed religion altogether? Here, too, the topic is far too large for one moment. But I would like to take us down one road for a while. So, covenant in the Hebrew Bible. Brit, as a biblical topic, is first introduced at the end of the Noah story. There, under the sign of the rainbow, God instructs Noah and the family not to murder, not to eat the limb of an animal while the animal yet lives. And out of this, the rabbis developed several more laws, a total of 7. The topic is brought up again in chapter 12 of the book of Genesis, when God invites Abraham to move away from his familial home under God's protection. I will make of you a great nation. Those who curse you, I will curse. Those who bless you, I will bless. All you need do, Abraham, is leave your home at age 75 with your 65-year-old wife Sarah and set up shop in Canaan, several hundred miles away. And some variation of this notion accompanies the forefathers, Isaac and Jacob. Then in Exodus, when God frees the Israelite slaves and is preparing to give them the Ten Commandments, God says to them, I took you out of Egypt on eagle's wings, which, by the way, in my mind is one of the most beautiful images in the whole Hebrew Bible. You shall be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. All you have to do is obey my laws. And then God gives the Ten Commandments. So in this sense, obedience to the deity is not predicated on this God's caprice. The laws are good laws. We can, and likely should, argue about some of those laws, such as, for example, the Torah's apparent disapproval of homosexuality. But regardless of our arguments with specific laws, be they many or few, this entailment of the covenant is that the relationship with God is brought into being. It's manifested and maintained through law. Obey me through the laws, the text is telling us, and life will be blessed. I am not sufficiently well versed in the laws of the ancient Near East, but my guess is that this is unique. We are not bound to a God who will make an irrational or murderous demand of us. Let me equivocate slightly. One may, as I said, have an argument here or there with the specifics of biblical law. However, by the time the rabbis of the second century and beyond inherit this system and compose what we know of as the Talmud, this concept is smoothed out considerably. Jewish law, halakha, is nothing if not an extended, rational legal system. So the traditional notion of covenant between God and the Jews goes something like this. I, God, will care for you, my people. In fact, as David Hartman puts it, I, God, will, as it were, limit my power over you and put in place a nearly symmetrical relationship based on my laws and your behavior. In return, you may make demands of me that defy the true reality of my being and your existence as mere mortals. Under most circumstances, you and I can be friends, equals. Thus, covenant is not merely a body of legal entailments, but a diminution, if not an entirely elimination, of power, the power relationship between two parties, where one party is a group of humans and the other is the Lord God himself. And so there is in Jewish tradition the image of arguing with God, of talking directly to God, expecting in some way or other that God will actually respond, and sometimes with a change of mind. But what I really want to do is talk about the spirituality of this idea, beyond the literalness of it, because the press of modernity raises questions about the literalness of it. We humans have enormous power to change things. That's, in fact, one of the notions that feeds the foundation of democracy, returning to the idea of democracy, that if we choose to exercise it, our voice can do a very great deal. Democracy is not a frozen event, one time fits all, one change fixes all. Democracy is about a continuum, a forward motion that institutes new realizations about the human condition, about the needs of the people in a given moment of time, in time. The Jewish notion of covenant, stripped of what Mordechai Kaplan, the founder of the Reconstructionist movement, called over and over again and railed against over and over again, its supernaturalism, the supernaturalism in the Jewish tradition, concerns passionately the dialogue between the needs of the people of the moment and the eternal ethical impulse of the Jewish tradition. Now, I fear that sentence may have been a little convoluted, so I'm going to restate it. Stripped of its supernaturalism, modern Jewish thinkers, and not only modern Jewish thinkers, but they're the ones I know the best, argued that you can see embedded in the tradition an eternal ethics or an eternal ethical impulse. Not necessarily specific ethics, although certainly some moral rules would last throughout the generations, but an impulse to do the good. That ethical impulse requires a continual visit and revisit of the sacred texts, the struggle to perceive in the texts their meaning and utility for today, with the assumption that the meaning is there to be found. In truth, we do not need to talk about the eternal ethical impulse of the Jewish tradition at all. All we need to speak of this morning is humanity's eternal ethical impulse and the need to exercise that impulse through examination of all of our sacred texts. Kaplan argued that the very fabric of the universe possesses the possibility to achieve individual and collective good, that who we are as a human race includes in our very DNA, although Kaplan would never use that term, the compulsion to ascertain what is good, to find it, because it's there when we search for it, then to bring it about and to build up the world through our efforts. We just recently commemorated the 50th anniversary of the Selma March, the march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama in 1965, one of the shaping moments of the civil rights movement, when thousands of leaders and many, among many others, gathered to press for equal rights for African Americans. If you see a picture, there's a famous picture. It's iconic. It's certainly iconic in the Jewish community. There's a photograph of the front line of that march. And in that front line, linking arms with Ralph Abernathy, Martin Luther King Jr., and Ralph Bunche, is Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who, though by no means the only rabbi to become involved in the civil rights movement, spoke loudly against the evils of racism. He said of that day, and this is also an iconic quote, at least in the Jewish community, quote, "When I marched in Selma, my feet were praying." In our days, we don't negotiate so much with God and expect an answer. Those who do receive answers are suspect. We are left with the image of a divine human relationship of symmetry, with the idea that the good, whose meaning may shift according to the needs of the moment, the good is knowable. In that way, modernity has given us the great gift of our ability to look each other in the eye and know we can work together in a symmetry, serve together in equality, build together and make changes together. We know that the ethical is ours to grasp, understand, and make manifest in this world of ours. Our covenant as Americans is with each other over and against the eternal ethical ideas. It exists with every man and every woman. Our covenant demands that we grasp what in the 19th century they called the moral law, to draw that law from our sacred traditions, to mold them as we understand them today, for our needs today, to build a world for today and for tomorrow. Our covenant, then, is an umbrella beneath which we dwell, striving to be a unified people, working toward common goals, guided by trust, by law, and by the prevailing sense, hearkening back to Abraham and Sarah, leaving one place to settle in another, that there is such a thing. There is such a thing as destiny, a future and fate that we share, a future that will be good as long as we join ourselves together in a vast covenantal sacred trust. And that is a stab at identifying covenant for today. Our continuing interaction with our texts, our history, ourselves, and understanding that as human beings we must let ourselves be bound together in an understanding that our shared humanity is the force that ought to draw us together, to be one for the good of all. Thank you.